Good morning. Thank you so much for being here, members and visitors alike. Last week, I preached a sermon where I encouraged us all to be humble and yet confident in our dealings and our associations. And if I didn't say so specifically, I think I probably implied it. That all things being equal, surely humble, confident people must be the most pleasant people in the world to be around. A real joy to see someone who knows who he is or she, and yet is not puffed up about it. And I forget whether it was just before or just after I preached the sermon Sunday morning. It crossed my mind to think for the first time, I wonder what the opposite of that would be. What would be the opposite of the best person to be around? And would that person, in fact, be the worst person to be around? And I thought, well, I guess the opposite of an humble, confident person would be an arrogant doubter. And I started thinking about that, and I thought, you know what? I think that might be the most unpleasant person to be around. A person who is completely puffed up, completely full of his own confidence, but not because of some kind of particular knowledge that he has necessarily, but in his assumption, or hers, that there's no knowledge to be had. That nothing is real, or certainly nothing should be assumed as being real. That everything is under doubt, everything is under scrutiny, that nothing really stands on its own. And that got me thinking about postmodernism, which is a philosophy that I have mentioned in brief any number of times, and I've mentioned any number of times that I would like to speak in more depth about it when the opportunity presents itself. And here we are with the opportunity presenting itself. So I would like a little bit of your time here this morning to talk about postmodernism and its impact, not just on the world that's around us in physical form, but also the philosophy itself and how it impacts our faith, and the dangers that it poses to us as Christians. And at this point, you're probably thinking, well, that's all very well and good, but what exactly is postmodernism? Well, we're going to talk a lot about what that means in practical terms. But in a nutshell, we're talking about this. The postmodernist thought, and the term goes back almost 150 years, but it really came into blossom about a generation or so ago, and it's really become almost the rule in certain philosophical circles today. The idea that all of the basic constructs and paradigms and assumptions that we have made about how the world works, about what is good and bad, or the existence itself of good and bad, that we need to basically throw away all of these assumptions, all of these concepts, and call all of them into doubt, that reality is fundamentally different than what we have always assumed it to be. You know, I grew up in a world where 2 plus 2 equals 4, right? Maybe you grew up in a world similar to that. And maybe my children did. I'm not quite sure about that. But the little ones these days are growing up in a world where a quantity that might be assumed to be 2 may or may not have been combined at some point in the past with another quantity that also may or may not be described as being 2, to come to a lump sum that could be qualified by some as being 4, but could equally be accurately described in a wide variety of other ways and other forms that are equally as valid. Does any of that sound familiar? That kind of thinking anyway, maybe a little bit exaggerated? That's postmodernism. And it finds its manifestation most of the time, for our purposes, in art and architecture. Usually when you talk about postmodernist this or postmodernist that, you're talking about art and architecture. And I want to emphasize here briefly that just because something is called postmodernist, that doesn't necessarily mean it's objectionable, and it certainly does not necessarily mean that the person who came up with this is himself going to accept the consequences of postmodernist theory. It's There are lots of people who dabble in postmodernism from an expression standpoint that maybe they just kind of like squares. I don't know. And they're not necessarily trying to change your world by doing this. Some expressions of postmodernism you may like. Some I kind of like. The best example is probably the Sydney Opera House, which I find attractive. I'm not exactly sure why, and that's usually the way it is with postmodernism. I like it. I'm not quite sure why, largely because everybody tells me I'm supposed to like it and how beautiful it is. But I can appreciate this. Some postmodernism can be beautiful. Some can be interesting. You know, some can be silly. There's also a blue one and a silver one and a gold one, I think, by the way. Some can be scary. Some can be weird. Well, a lot of it can be weird. Some can be just downright ugly. And some can be maybe a little bit dangerous. And maybe some of this is going to kind of work itself out. I don't really live in fear that in the next 20 to 50 years, all of the buildings that you see are going to look like that. I cannot see that happening. I think that may kind of work itself out. And I'm not terribly concerned about one way or the other, as long as I don't have to live in a building like that. What I am concerned about is that this postmodernist look at reality is starting to change the framework of the world that we live in. Every day we see it. And we're going to talk about how exactly that works. But in case you haven't engaged yet in the concept of the lesson, let me kind of ruin the ending for you a little bit here. Maybe this morning, maybe last week, you probably picked up the newspaper, or you went online, or however it is that you find out about the world these days. And you ran across some kind of news item that blew your mind. And you were left thinking, how in the world can this happen? How in the world can this be? I'll tell you what it was for us. We were discussing this this week. A woman named Lena Dunham, actress, social warrior, professional idiot, you know, whatever you want to classify herself as. She was in an airport, and apparently she ran across, or her story is anyway, that she ran across some representatives of a particular airline. And they were saying something derogatory about a certain demographic group. And she didn't appreciate that very much. And she went on Twitter and told everybody about it. And the core of her story almost immediately was called into question. And a lot of people started thinking that she very likely embellished a lot of this, or maybe just made the whole thing up out of whole cloth. And her response to this was, "My truth is that this happened." And I hear that word, my truth. When you hear that, think postmodernism. That's what that is. We are beginning to live in a world where my truth, that is the world that I have in my mind, that I have constructed, maybe out of some evidence, maybe out of some prejudices, maybe out of some visions that I have or whatever, has become as valid, if not more valid, than actual events in actual time that actually happened. The next time you see something that defies all logic, and you think, how in the world could people think that? How in the world could people accept that? There's no evidence at all. All the evidence proves, beyond a shadow of a doubt, that this is not true. None of this is real. They have to know that. after this lesson, hopefully you will understand a little bit more about that. It's not a matter of whether the facts are on our side. It's a matter of how relevant facts are, and if, in fact, there is even such a thing as facts, for our purposes anyway. That's the postmodern world that we're starting to live in. And we can go on and on and on for hours about it. We're not going to do that. Let's talk about the doubt. We'll talk about the arrogance a little bit at the end, but let's talk about the doubt. Postmodernists, in the first place, doubt the concept of objective truth. The idea that something is right or something is wrong is a philosophy that is outdated as far as the postmodernists are concerned. The idea of actual truth is ruled out. And it's not going to be very difficult throughout this lesson for you to attach the concept of atheism or agnosticism to the idea of postmodernism. And I'm persuaded, I don't know how conscious this is, I don't know how deliberate this is, but clearly the world that has separated itself more and more from God, by its very nature, is also separating itself from God's principles, including the principle of truth. As basic as that may be for you and me, it's not basic to other people. We read in the Bible, chapter 1, verse 17, that grace and truth is realized through Jesus Christ. That he brings truth into our world and into our lives and into our heart. And he reveals it to us in the Bible. That word is capable of equipping us. All scripture, 2 Timothy 3, verse 16 and 17, is given by inspiration of God and is profitable for doctrine, reproof, correction, training in righteousness. That the man of God may be complete or adequate, thoroughly furnished into every good work. So that's about 8 different versions that I'm paraphrasing there. But your version is going to read basically the same way. The word is given to us as a concrete pillar upon which we can rest ourselves, something we can take as granted, something that is real, something that is substantial, something we can build a life around. And we can build around it because we have confidence that it came from God. If it didn't come from God, then what's the point? You may have your particular philosophy, I may have my particular philosophy. What's the difference? No difference. The difference comes in when God gives us truth. Now, we could talk about scientific truth or historical truth or whatever, and those are relevant for this conversation. But here, primarily, we're talking about spiritual truth. The existence of God himself. The existence of a plan that God has for his creation. This is real. This has been given to us by God. Now, if you are adopting a postmodernist kind of way of looking at the world, if you are rejecting the notion of God and of God's truth, then in the absence of God's truth, you are left to come up with your own kind of truth. And if you're coming up with your own concept of truth, wouldn't it be neat if you could find a truth that suited your own personal purposes? Is this starting to sound like kindergarten? Well, I don't like the reality that I'm living in, and so I'm going to choose this other reality. Well, that's Johnny's crayon. You can't use Johnny's crayon. No, it's my crayon. No, it's not. It's Johnny's crayon. It has Johnny's name on it. No, it doesn't. Well, let's just see about that. Well, there's Johnny. No, that's not Johnny. That's my name. I'm Johnny. That's not a crayon. Yep. Who are you? Whatever argument they're making on the playground these days. We can come up with our own truth this way. Well, wouldn't that be neat? The idea that we can revise the world and wind up with the world that we like, wind up with the world that we appreciate, that we approve of, that serves our own short-term purposes. Now, that's not exactly what the Jews were doing in Romans chapter 10, verse 3. They acknowledged the existence of God. They acknowledged the existence of truth. They acknowledged God's truth to a certain degree. But they rejected the implications of the Old Testament when they rejected Jesus Christ. They have a zeal for God, Paul said of his countrymen, but not in accordance with knowledge. For, he says in verse number 3, not knowing about God's righteousness and seeking to establish their own, They did not subject themselves to the righteousness of God. Now think about this. If you can reject God's wisdom and reject God's wisdom and come up with your own righteousness that is somewhat founded on a God principle and somewhat founded on a righteousness principle and a morality principle, and become this far afield from God's plan for your life, imagine what would happen with somebody who does not care anything about God, who does not care anything about God's truth, who in fact rejects the notion of God, rejects the notion of God's truth. They seek to accomplish their own righteousness. And because they're interested in forming their own world, they reject God's world. Now, for 2,000 years, we've been wrestling with this, and well, longer than that, on a spiritual level. God has spiritual truth. We have our own truth that's in violation of that. And it's been a spiritual conflict, and that's all it was. But we're seeing more and more in our society today, the next step, the next phase. If you're going to reject God's ability and authority to exercise His will in spiritual matters, why not reject it in physical matters? Why not reject His truth with regard to philosophy, for instance? Or any number of other social sciences that we might come up with. And after we get used to bending all the rules with psychology and those kind of sciences, then comes grammar. This is the way that you're supposed to express yourself. Everybody realizes this is truth. Well, we're going to do something else, and it's going to be truth too. Or it's going to be truth instead. And after we're done changing all the rules of grammar, now we're going to change the rules of history. And before too long, we're changing the rules of science. Nothing is going to be consistent. Nothing is going to be accepted simply because it's so. Because it's truth. Because postmodernism has rejected the notion. Now, what does this look like for our purposes? We talked about this a little bit when we read in Isaiah chapter 55 earlier, and I don't want to read the entire text again. But the notion here of rejecting Bible principles in favor of current philosophy is something that is, it's not a problem out there. It's a problem in here. Lest you think this is some kind of diatribe against all these weird people that you see out there in the world. It has nothing really to do with the Church of Jesus Christ. Let me disabuse you of that notion. We may not be people, have people here in our midst who are saying that the law of gravity doesn't exist. But we do have people among the people of God who will reject Bible principles, throw away real bread for that which is not bread, buy wholeheartedly into the concept. They will reject the notion that God's ways are higher than our ways, that His thoughts are higher than our thoughts. They will come up with their own philosophy of how the world works, or else swallow whole somebody else's philosophy. And if that means rejecting Bible concepts, Bible principles, and we're going to talk more about specifics of morality and such as we go, then they're willing to do that. And if you find yourself, please listen to me on this. If you find yourself in conversation with maybe a brother in Christ or sister in Christ, and the subject comes up, some kind of Bible principle about parenting, for instance, or about work, or about basic morality, or gender roles, or whatever it happens to be, and this person comes to you with Bible and says, the Bible teaches that this is the way that's supposed to work. And you find yourself responding, yes, I realize that's what the Bible teaches. But in our modern society, we have to blah, 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 blah. Watch yourself in that situation. Catch yourself. Are we really going to believe the Bible? Are we going to accept it as God's truth? Or are we going to accept it whenever it doesn't conflict very much with some other philosophy that we got from some other person? If we accept Bible truth, let's accept all Bible truth on all subjects. Now, I said we'd mention some other specifics here. Objective reality. The world that we live in. What actually exists. The last couple of years especially. I say sometimes I refuse to be surprised by anything. That may not, strictly speaking, be true. I'm getting there, though. The world and its notions of how things work or how things ought to work is staggering sometimes. And again, like we said before, the notion of going to them and saying, how can you possibly deny these facts? How can you possibly assert that this is reality when clearly it's not? There's absolutely no reason to believe that it is. And the words just, you can just kind of see them flying right over their head. They don't get it. It's because they have accepted a postmodern version of reality. And in postmodernism, this is the cool part. I hope I'm not convincing anybody to become a postmodernist here. But with postmodernism, you don't have to accept the reality that there is. You can make your own reality. I think I mentioned before, a couple weeks ago, how there are people who are claiming that we're living in the Matrix now. You know, the world that is around you is not real. It's a postmodernist concept. The idea that this is not reality. This is some kind of dream state. We're all under some mass hypnosis. And we know that because, you know, you couldn't possibly hire a game show host to be the president of the United States. God requires us to live in the world that he gave us. That's not always a pleasant prospect. It's certainly not a perfect prospect. But this is the world that we live in. And we have to accept, and this doesn't have to be a bad thing, by the way. It certainly has bad consequences. But there are positive lessons to take from this. We accept that the world that we live in has flaws. It's broken. It has been since the fall. Solomon writes for us in Ecclesiastes 1, verse 12 and following, I, the preacher, have been king over Israel in Jerusalem, and I set my mind to seek and explore by wisdom concerning all that has been done under heaven. It is a grievous task which God has given the sons of men to be afflicted with. I've seen all the works which have been done under the sun, and behold, all is vanity and striving after wind. What is crooked cannot be straightened, and what is lacking cannot be counted. Not only is the world broken, it's getting more broken, and there's nothing you can do about it. Nothing Solomon could do, nothing you can do, nothing I can do. And there's nothing God will do, at least in the short term. He'll fix it eventually in rather dramatic fashion. But in the meantime, we are required to live in this world. And if it doesn't make sense or if it's objectionable in some ways, that should be an opportunity for you to turn to God. And ask him for comfort, and ask him for direction, and ask him for meaning behind all of this. The meaning is there. If this world is imperfect, strive to live in the next world, which will not be imperfect. The less sense this world makes, the more we should hope for a different world. What we should not do is reimagine the world that we're in and create some kind of false construction simply to make us feel better about ourselves. I think that's what safe spaces are all about. You know, the world that I live in is unpleasant. I didn't like the way that the president of my university responded. I don't like the thing that the president is doing and the Congress is doing. I don't like the protests that are going on, the protests that are not going on, or whatever. And so, therefore, I am going to reject reality. I'm going to crawl into a little bubble, and I'm going to hug my teddy bear, and I'm going to color with my crayons and such until the problems all go away. And in the meantime, I'm just going to live in this little world that doesn't have problems. It's a postmodernist way of looking at things. Refusing to accept reality. Refusing to deal with reality. By insisting upon our own reality, though, we give ourselves a special kind of power. We are not accepting the reality that the Creator has given us. We are instead asserting our own ability to become creators. We are going to make ourselves a world. A rather flagrant violation of the principle given to us in Psalm 100, verse 3, where it is, He that has created us, not we ourselves. That's why we worship God. That's why we serve Him, because He made us. We did not make ourselves. The postmodernist says, but I am making myself. I'm making my own world. I'm making my own reality. And there are specific examples of this. Rather ridiculous examples. We look at, and I don't want to get overly graphic and gross about the whole transgenderism thing, but the Bible teaches us about reality. The Bible teaches us that from the beginning God made them male and female. And in our postmodern society, people say, no, that's not true. You make your own reality. If you feel like a woman, then be a woman. If you feel like a man, then you be a man. You can go through the surgery. You can not go through the surgery. What difference does it make? You want to imagine yourself to be a cat? Then be a cat. You want to imagine yourself to be a piece of furniture? Be a piece of furniture. I'm not making this stuff up. You know I'm not. You've seen this too. And the friend goes, because they care about their friend, right? And let me try to explain to you why you're not a piece of furniture. And you show pictures of furniture, and you show the person a mirror, and you know, all these kind of things, and none of it seems to work. See, you're dealing in a world of facts. The postmodernist doesn't care about facts. Facts are irrelevant. You heard the story about the fellow who thinks that he's dead and goes to the doctor because his wife is concerned about him and cannot convince him. And the doctor says, I got this. And so the doctor tells him all about blood and about blood flow and how the body circulates and the heart beats and sends the blood. And the man seems to be getting it. Oh, you understand all this? Oh, sure, I get this. And he says, well, dead people don't bleed because the heart's not pumping. And they study this for a couple of weeks. And you convince me. Dead people do not bleed. And then the doctor reaches out with his knife and he cuts the guy on the hand. And he starts bleeding. And he looks down at his hand and he says, well, what do you know? Dead people do bleed after all. We become convinced of our own realities. And there's a certain comfort there, I suppose. There's a sense of control that we think that we're exercising. But it's fake. It's a dream. It's imaginary. Abortion works the same way. All the facts, and we could go on for hours about this, we're not going to, but all the facts support the notion that a man and a woman come together and they make a baby. And the sperm impregnates the egg and the cell division and the embryo becomes the fetus and all this kind of thing. Generally speaking, for thousands and thousands of years, we didn't worry about any of that. We just said the woman has a baby in her tummy. And that was the end of it. The Bible refers to pregnancy in those terms. For instance, Luke 1 verse 44 talks about the baby leaping in her womb. And if you believe that an unborn fetus, unborn embryo is not in fact human, this passage is not going to convince you otherwise. And I understand that. But in a broader kind of sense, the notion of, I don't have a baby, this is not real, is a postmodernist thought. And before we had any facts, you didn't have to deal with it on this level. The evolutionists told us that ontogeny recapitulates phylogeny, which is a fancy way of saying that your little baby goes through the entire evolutionary process in your womb. It becomes this multicelled organism, and then it becomes a little worm, and then it becomes a fish, and it becomes an amphibian, a reptile, and a mammal, and eventually, right there at the end, turns into a human being, and then you have the baby. That worked fine before we had tools, photographs, and sonograms, and ultrasounds, and that kind of thing. As soon as the information started coming in, we realized this is complete and total balderdash. None of that happens. Well, that didn't defeat the abortionist, of course. That didn't defeat the postmodernist. He doesn't care what the fetus looks like. Doesn't care what the embryo looks like. You can prove that a baby has heartbeat and brain waves 18 weeks after conception, 18 days, rather, after conception. Well, if I have a heartbeat and brain waves, I'd appreciate you not killing me, you know, because I'm alive. That would be a murder. Well, if an unborn embryo or unborn fetus has a heart rate and brain waves, doesn't mean we're supposed to not kill him. Irrelevant. In my mind, this is a disease. In my mind, this is an affliction or a social difficulty or a reality I just choose not to accept. And so therefore, I'm going to get rid of this. The facts don't make any difference. And we'll talk about morality here also a little bit. And maybe this is a little bit closer to home for us. I don't know that any of you are thinking that maybe the whole transgender thing is not that big of a deal. Maybe if a man wants to be a woman, that's fine. I don't know that we're quite that far. But we see inroads being made with regard to morality all the time. God is, in fact, a holy being and requires holiness of his people. 1 Peter 1, verse 14 through 16. I refer to this passage a lot. Be ye holy, for I am holy. This is our task as human beings, to accept his version of morality and put it to work in our lives by choice, deliberately. And if we refuse to do so, we are refusing to submit to the rule of our Heavenly Father. This is God's morality. I am aware that you and I get accused a lot of trying to bind our morals, trying to bind our principles, trying to bind our faith on other people. And hopefully we do not present it like that. You don't suit my purposes. You don't suit my vision of what the world ought to be. And so therefore you're rejected. And as far as I'm concerned, you're a heretic and an infidel. Hopefully we don't put it that way, because that's not right. What we are doing is we are accepting objective morality as given to us by God, as defined by God. It's not our standards they're refusing to measure up to. It's God's standards that they're refusing to measure up to. It's not us that they are rejecting. It is God that they are rejecting. But a sinner, someone who has rejected the principles of God, will not waste a whole lot of time in rejecting God's principles of morality. In fact, you could argue, maybe a little bit cynically, that's part of the reason why they rejected God in the first place. So they could do whatever they wanted to do. See, if I accept God, I have to accept God's rules. But then I reject God, I can do whatever I want to do. I have accepted a reality where there is no God. I have accepted a reality where there is no objective obligations that are placed upon me. And so I'll probably try to avoid the stuff that sent me to jail, because I don't want to go to jail. You know, maybe I'm not going to do drugs just because, you know, I don't like the idea of doing drugs. I may choose not to cheat on my spouse or whatever. But as far as actual morals, things are wrong because they're wrong. No. It's wrong for me. It may not be wrong for you. That's the way over and over again it's presented to us. And I don't want to make it sound like that we invented this concept in 21st century America, because we did not. It is simply a modern retelling of the same story that has been going on forever. And again, maybe we're putting the cart before the horse here. Maybe it's not the philosophy that creates the morality. Maybe it's the morality that creates the philosophy. The idea that we don't want to do what God has told us to do, and so therefore we'll accept a reality that rejects God. In Isaiah chapter 5 and verse number... Oh, we'll start in verse number, let's skip down to verse number 20. Woe to those who call evil good and good evil, who substitute darkness for light and light for darkness, who substitute bitter for sweet and sweet for bitter. Woe to those who are wise in their own eyes and clever in their own sight. Woe to those who are heroes in drinking wine and valiant men in mixing strong drink, who justify the wicked for a bribe and take away the rights of the ones who are in the right. And in this entire context is talking about this reality that people have accepted for themselves in rejection, in rebellion against God's morality. All these bad things that God's been telling us to avoid, those are actually good things. Which is, by the way, exactly what the devil told Eve in the Garden of Eden. Yes, I know that is the wrong fruit, but as it happens, it's the right fruit. That's what you ought to be doing. It's not what you ought to avoid doing. It's what you ought to be doing. Because in so doing, you're empowering yourself. You're making yourself better than God. You see how rejecting God's morals gives a person that sense of empowerment? I don't have to answer to God anymore. I don't have to listen to his rules. And this philosophy, by the way, is you watch any kind of teen movie and you get nothing but this. You know, reject your parents' values. You know, they said go left, go right, just because it's different. They don't know what they're doing. You need to do your own thing. You need to rebel. And most of them survive, you know, through 2 hours of that. And teach our young people, taught me when I was growing up, that rebelling against authority is an inherently good thing. But it's not. God is not going to be mocked, though. Whatever man sows, that will he also reap. We see applications of this in our everyday existence in the church. There are certain immoralities painted out for us in 1 Corinthians 5, verse number 11, including adultery and fornication. That is not only accepted, but oftentimes applauded in the world that is around us, just as it was in Corinth back in the day. And if we choose to reject God's principles that are laid out for us in various passages, including 1 Corinthians chapter 5, and extend fellowship to those who have rejected God's morality, because our version of morality has been tampered with somehow by human philosophy, then we are setting ourselves up as God on earth. We have rejected his will. Moral relativism. You know, it's, again, maybe it's wrong for you, not wrong for me, or vice versa. The idea that situation ethics, things may change a little bit. Paul says in Romans chapter 3, verse 4, rather let God be found true, though every man be found a liar. We live in a world today where God is made a liar by one man. Any man, frankly. Used to be like maybe a really smart team of scientists or archaeologists or biologists or whatever. Doesn't have to be that anymore. Someone knucklehead in his basement. That's good. That's all you need. One person. No, God's lying to me. I've decided this other thing is true. Again, facts don't matter. Now, having said all that, let's talk a little bit about arrogance before we close up. The arrogance in this doubt, the arrogance in rejecting objective truth, objective morality, objective reality and morality, the arrogance comes in when, again, you become God in and of yourself. Science itself is going to be deified. And when you turn science into God, you're turning the scientist into God here. And I hasten to add here, I'm a big fan of science. I think science is fascinating. I think it's part of our task on earth to conquer the world, to subdue it, is understanding the scientific processes that hold the whole thing together. They were instituted by God and occasionally broken by God. But when science is seen as the ultimate pursuit of truth, or the ultimate pursuit of facts, or the ultimate opponent of God, essentially science becomes God itself. And the irony is, in all of this, that these scientists that are overwhelmingly evolutionary completely reject the notion that they themselves could be wrong. And I say it's ironic because science does, in fact, evolve. You want to talk about evolution? I'll show an example of evolution. Hold on a second. See this? This evolved. Back 200 years ago or so, a man named Samuel Morse figured out how to send messages through a wire by doing this thing. Never been done before. Amazing. Before too long, we were doing it with voice. The voice going through the wire. Didn't need the tap, tap, tap anymore. And before too long, you didn't need the wire. within my lifetime, it's been accomplished without the wire. And now we have these. We have smartphones. And we're back to the tap, 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 which I don't quite understand. But whatever. This grew. You hand this to Samuel Morse, he wouldn't know what to do with it. The thing was witchcraft. But our scientific knowledge has evolved over the years. And now the modern scientists are trying to tell us that they have all the answers. Well, you know what? The scientists 100 years ago, they said the same thing. And modern scientists laugh at them. Well, they meant well. But we're smarter than they are. We've evolved farther than they have. But the answers that we have come up with and that we are presenting to you in your college classroom are the final answers. This is it. You know, the high school student back when I was growing up goes to his chemistry class. He does the 3D model of the atom from Niels Bohr, you know, the protons and the neutrons and the electrons. And this is the way atoms are. And, oh, Johnny, you're such a genius. Thank you. You get an A. And then Johnny is all proud of himself, and he goes off to college, and he goes into his chemistry class, and his chemistry professor says, yeah, that's probably not true. None of that's really true. It works. I mean, you can figure out some answers to the question, but that's not really what atoms look like. There are people who, you know, the Bernoulli's theorem, which explains why planes fly, it has to do with changing air pressures and such over a curved surface. There are people today who will tell you that Bernoulli's theorem is wrong. That does not explain man flight. Now, we fly. We still have, but we don't know why. It's not Bernoulli's theorem that does that. Now, I'm not an airflow scientist. I can't tell you one way or the other. But I will tell you this, that in a year and 10 years and 50 years, we're going to learn much more about how the world works. And the idea that we have all the answers right now, it's just ridiculous. Solomon knew it back in his day. Of the writing of books, there is no end, he said. And imagine how many books have been written since then. Science simply is not equipped, cannot possibly give us final answers regarding either origins or destinations. This will be true until scientists invent a time travel device. Until you get time travel, which is one of the reasons why I don't think we'll ever get time travel. We may have some evidence about where we came from, and we may have some kind of evidence about where we may be going, but as far as actual snapshots of what we started with and what we ended with, science cannot explain that. Impossible for it to do it. Only God can do that. Because God was there. And God told us, thankfully. Arrogance is revealed when our faith is ridiculed, when our willingness to accept God's word instead of the word of some human being is called into question. And we're running a little long here. I'm not going to go back and read the entire text there in 1 Corinthians chapter 1, verse 26, but you know the text there, where the people think by their own wisdom they rejected God. I'm too smart to believe in God. I'm too smart to accept God. And if you accept God, then you're just not as smart as I am. You haven't gotten to where I am. That's the arrogance of the person who has rejected any kind of real, substantial knowledge. God is going to be rejected ultimately because we are too egotistical to conceive of one greater than ourselves. I really think this is what it is. God does not fit into the brain of a human being. And so the human being who thinks his brain is the answer to everything rejects God. I am not anti-knowledge. I'm not anti-science. I'm not anti-education. I know some absolutely brilliant people who have as much faith as anybody I've ever known. But that being said, when we get to a point where we think that we have the answers, that we are the ultimate, it leaves no room in our heart for God. It leaves no room in our heart for faith. Very briefly, let me give you a few basic tips on what to do with regard to such ones. How do we deal with the arrogant doubter? First of all, I suggest you do not get bogged down in pointless discussions. There's a great expression given to us in Proverbs 26, verse 4. Do not answer a fool according to his folly. Just don't chase the rabbit. Don't go down that hole. if there is a person who has rejected the concept of truth, there's no point in having some kind of Bible discussion with him unless he is open to the possibility that maybe there might be some learning opportunities here. Now, as long as life exists, hope exists. But let's not spin our wheels beating our head against a wall in causes that show no potential. Similarly, though, if we have a legitimate opportunity, make good use of it. The very next verse goes on to say, answer a fool as his folly deserves. That seems like a contradiction, but I don't think it is. It's simply a different way of looking at things. There are some fools who refuse to learn, and there are some fools who are just resisting learning. And they may not be the most politically correct word these days, I don't know. The Bible uses it, so I'll use it. As we have opportunities to talk to people, take advantage of them. Understand where they're coming from. Understand their background, the burdens that they're carrying into the discussion. And deal with them at that level instead of some highfalutin kind of discussion about God and providence and inspiration and all that. Let's deal with facts. Let's go look at a sunset. You really think that that happens on accident? Or do you think that came from God? And protect yourself ultimately against becoming a fool yourself more than anything else. The fool is the one who says in his heart, there is no God. Psalm 14 discusses him extensively. Do not allow that to be the case. If you want to read some kind of postmodern philosophy, if you want to become a neorealism painter or whatever, that's your business. I wouldn't tell you no. But when you see your faith going by the wayside, when you see yourself acting and talking less like a person of faith, put the brakes on. Remember who you are. Remember where you came from. Do not allow people to sap you of what makes you a Christian. Sap you of what sets you apart as this people for God's own possession we talked about earlier today. Build your faith. It's not always easy in the world that we live in, but you can and you must do it. I'm going to give an opportunity to those who need to respond to the invitation to make their life right with God, to accept His will, simply because it's His will, accept His truth, and quit trying to do things ourselves. Go where He is leading us, and be grateful for the opportunity. If you need to make your life right with God, in whatever way may be necessary, if you need to accept Him as your Lord and Savior and put Him on in baptism, if you need to acknowledge some kind of sin in your life that may be of a public nature, whatever we can do to help you walk with Christ a little bit more perfectly, and walk toward heaven eventually, after this life is over, as our faith requires us to do and promises will be ours in due course of time. Whatever we can do, please respond to the invitation while we stand and sing at this time.